The following is a special presentation of Tony Curry Radio. Want the real story behind the sound bites and headlines? Let's find the facts. Remember, it's not a conspiracy theory if it's the truth. You are not paranoid or confused. You just need to know.
Welcome, everybody. It's time for Need to Know, the Thanksgiving week edition. Yes, we've reached the first major holiday of the fall period. Of course, a lot of people look at Thanksgiving now as a sort of a kickoff, a diving platform, if you will, into the Christmas season, which it's fine that it's evolved that way. And, you know, it's part of the history of the actual holiday that officially, and we're going to talk about the unofficial beginnings of Thanksgiving a little bit, because a lot of folks don't know the real story, the actual story, or as Paul Harvey would say, the rest of the story on Thanksgiving's origins. We're going to talk about that. But Thanksgiving officially became a holiday in the fall of 1863, after the Battle of Gettysburg and Abraham Lincoln traveling to Gettysburg and delivering maybe the most famous speech in American history, just a 2.5 minute speech, as it were, which in this day and age would never be, it's a sound bite, but that's all it took for him to deliver the Gettysburg Address. And, you know, Lincoln, as we've talked about here, I love history and I always like sharing it with folks, because I think one of the saddest things in our current system in our country is the de-emphasis of history by the activists, the indoctrinators, the brainwashers that have been there, put in place to not emphasize the history of this nation and all of the great things it's accomplished, but to instead try and poison the minds of young students and brainwash them into believing that this country is evil and racist and not opportunistic in terms of everybody having an equal chance of achieving the American dream. Anytime I get a chance to tell some accurate history to refute that, I like to do it. Lincoln celebrated because the Battle of Gettysburg on July 1st through 3rd of 1863 really was the turning point in the Civil War. It looked bad. I mean, really bad for the United States of America, for the Union, for Abraham Lincoln. It truly was a situation that was in a dire circumstance. And, you know, as it turned out, that battle kind of turned the tide of everything that was happening. So he declared a national day of Thanksgiving that would be on the final Thursday of every November. And that only held up for a brief period, because Lincoln revised that, I think even the next year, to have it on the Thursday preceding the final Thursday, only to give more opportunity for people to start, you know, again, kind of celebrating the Christmas season, to give people more of an opportunity to use that kickoff for Thanksgiving. As you know, it's hard to believe that in the 1860s, during a war between the states, the emphasis was on sales of Christmas merchandise, and not so much gifts, but, you know, people prepared their feasts and needed to have all of their plans for Christmas. And, you know, had to budget for that in a lot of circumstances, particularly in wartime. But anyway, that's where it was decided that it's going to be on the on that Thursday on the calendar that gives more time at the end of the month. Typically, this year we have a late Thanksgiving because it falls on the 27th of the month. And I think it's the fourth Thursday of every November is the way it's set up, because sometimes the calendar falls where there'll be five Thursdays, and he did not want to have it at right at the, like, if it's like November 30th, because that would be too late. So this is about the latest date you're going to get. Usually it's going to fall right around the 24th or 25th. Anyway, that's a lot of gibberish about nothing important. But that's when the holiday was actually established. Abraham Lincoln, 1863, declaring the fourth Thursday in November, Thanksgiving. But the origins, of course, the story you hear is about the Indians coming down and making a brotherhood appearance and embracing the pilgrims who had landed on the Mayflower in 1620 in Plymouth, Massachusetts. The pilgrims had set up shop there, of course, had begun their colony, the Plymouth Colony. I've been to Plymouth in recent years, and it's, you can feel the history and the nostalgia. The whole town is sort of themed from that memorable place that they landed, which was like 200 miles off. They were aiming for Virginia. They missed it by that much because they landed in Massachusetts. But, you know, all things considered, to just land anywhere was an accomplishment. So, Plymouth right now, supposedly Plymouth Rock is on display, not on the beach where the ships allegedly came in and anchored. No, the Plymouth Rock has now been moved up to the main street of the town and put in this kind of bizarre underground well thing down into the, it's about 15 feet down. You stand on the street, it's surrounded by a railing, and you stick your head over the railing and look down, and supposedly in the bottom of this pit, right on this the city street with traffic going by, you see what's allegedly Plymouth Rock. My son at the time, Clayt, was about 13 or 14 years old. This, I said a few years ago, this has been 15 years ago. Clayt, of course, gets right on his phone and starts Googling, because he's already just the kind of person who's already suspicious that maybe this is kind of BS. And he does discover that the rock was identified positively by a 92-year-old guy who was on the Mayflower some 50 years after the fact that it landed. They actually, this guy wasn't even mobile anymore. They actually carried this old dude down to the beach and had him point out which formation of rocks were the actual Plymouth Rocks where the ships landed. And he, you know, told him, yeah, that's them right there. You know, like Clayt said at the time, and this is with tourists all surrounding this display and a tour guide telling the story. And Clayt says loud enough for my other son, Case, and I to hear, and for most of the crowd to hear that, you know, this is all BS. They brought some old dude down who was like 50 years removed, and he said this was one of the rocks, and then they moved it up here, you know, 50 years ago and put it on the street. He said, this is probably not genuine. So anyway, so even some questions if we were actually looking at one of the actual Plymouth Rocks, but that's how that all started. Well, immediately, the pilgrims discovered, as they started to try and get this area, you know, developed into their colony, set up shop, if you will. And, of course, the most important thing was to find some kind of crop they could grow so they could sustain themselves through the winter months that first year they were there. And the pilgrims were struggling. This was brand new land, brand new topography that they hadn't dealt with. The weather patterns, again, they thought they were landing in Virginia. They missed that. So the climate a little harsher on the coast of Massachusetts than it is on the Virginia coast. Of course, it's not that much different, but, you know, still significantly colder. Anyway, the pilgrims were struggling, and they, of course, you know, commenced hunting as one of their primary ways to develop food while they tried to grow crops. And that got the attention of the Wampanoag Indian tribe that was right in that area, based there. Wampanoag Indians, interesting name that a lot of people in history don't remember or never learn. But the Wampanoags were absolutely obsessed with the fact that the pilgrims came to the new world packing. They brought their firearms. And you say, you know, she's 1620. They already had guns. But yes, indeed, they did. Europe had developed the firearm in the previous century. It was in widespread use. The pilgrims were using it for hunting. And the Wampanoags, wondering who these invaders to their territory were, kind of tracked them. They were always kind of present, but they never really intervened with the pilgrims because they really didn't know who the hell they were. For all they knew, they had come from, they were dressed differently. They looked different. They were not the run-of-the-mill people that the Wampanoags were used to. Now, the Wampanoags had plenty of company. There were two other tribes in that area, the Narragansett tribe, which was the biggest and most powerful, and the Pequot, who was another big tribe, in that geographic region. And all three of those tribes were periodically involved in different skirmishes, wars, conflicts, all fighting for, territory and, hunting grounds and whatever else the issues of the day were. So, the narrative that's kind of painted that these peaceful bands of Indians were populating the country, they're called Native Americans, which is a ridiculous term because they were natives, I guess, but they had come from somewhere else. They didn't just pop up here randomly, and they weren't Americans. The country wasn't named anything because it wasn't a country. It was a territory with a bunch of tribal land divvied up, not in a formal way. It was, you could take this place and develop it, and that was your stronghold, and other tribes would periodically attack you if you had a better spot than they did or you had something they wanted. So this wasn't this peaceful kumbaya, one nation of Native Americans. It was indigenous peoples of all different tribes and all different motivations and all different stages of development. So that's the first narrative that you need to understand. The reason that the Wampanoags were so engrossed with the pilgrims was they immediately noticed their firearms. And, this was something that was never conceived. They were still fighting probably with sticks, maybe the earliest forms of bows and arrows and that kind of thing, and hunting. So that being introduced to the landscape was pretty amazing. And the Wampanoags just kind of stayed in the shadows and observed, but they saw right away that the pilgrims, in their attempts to grow crops, were doing some of the wrong things and tried to grow some of the wrong crops. So the original situation, the Wampanoags approached the pilgrims at some point and basically, and this is amazing because there was no way they had anybody that could be a interpreter. So I always find it fascinating, and I can't find any real good historical explanations of how these people managed to communicate. It had to be somebody had some creative ideas. Maybe they drew pictures. Maybe they just used different hand signals or whatever. But at some point, they finally broke through and were able to kind of crude communicate with each other. And basically the deal was, we're going to help you set up shop here and teach you how to grow crops to sustain your colony. In exchange for you, hand over some of those firearms you have and give us the leg up in our wars with the Pequots and the Narragansetts. And that was the kind of the deal they struck. So the second year that the pilgrims were in America, which was not America yet, of course, 1621, they had a big harvest, the Indians interacting with them. And it's even funny, the term Indian. They're only Indians because Christopher Columbus had, in the late 1400s, of course, sailed for the New World and landed in the Caribbean somewhere. And he thought he had gone all the way around the globe and landed in India. That was his goal. He came up just a little short on that, too. Once again, navigation, not too good. No GPS in those days. But he actually landed I think it is, Hispaniola, an island in the Caribbean. And immediately when was accosted by natives from that island, he immediately declared them Indians because he thought he was on the in the country of India. So all of the terms Native Americans, Indians, all of those were misnomers. These were indigenous people on the land that probably came, judging by the appearance of the original indigenous people, probably migrated at some stage of history from the Asian world. So Columbus was on the right track. He was just about 20,000 miles short. Coming across the Alaska Peninsula and into modern day Western Canada and even the Western United States. But the fact that all these tribes were on the coast of the Atlantic Ocean in Massachusetts and all the way down the eastern seaboard that we have now. I mean, think about that migration from Asia to Plymouth, Massachusetts. That's inconceivable in its own right. So there's so many fascinating facts. But the Pilgrims, because of the interaction with the indigenous folks, the Wampanoag tribe, had a successful harvest. The things they were taught were great. And I can't remember some of the specific crops, but it's nothing that I would eat right now. I'm going to Roost Chris on Thursday and having steak and lobster for my Thanksgiving dinner, because I always say, if the Pilgrims had been given a choice whether to eat, whatever greens or, plants that they were able to cultivate, or whatever small animals they were able to shoot, badgers or maybe a turkey or two. But if they had the choice and could have a fillet and lobster, I think the Pilgrims would have gone that route. So in honor of their lack of opportunity, that's what I always gravitate to on Thanksgiving Day. You can keep your cranberries and rutabagas and all the traditional Thanksgiving food that I wouldn't eat if you put one of those Pilgrim muskets to my head. I'm going to celebrate in my own fashion, as I do every year on Thursday, and go have a fantastic feast in honor of the Pilgrims who didn't have that opportunity. So when that harvest took place, the Pilgrims declared it a three-day festival of worship and celebration and thankfulness to God. And the Indians, who had been their partners in that, actually came down and partook, because again they were in sort of a treaty situation, and the acquisition of firearms, of course, by the Native Americans, actually the indigenous folks, as I just explained, really kind of changed the whole equation there, because as more and more settlers started coming to the country, more and more Indian tribes became equipped with firearms, which really changed the balance of power with a lot of tribes, and it determined of those tribes who survived and who got wiped out. So that's the real story of how it happened. That first Thanksgiving, it wasn't this wives' tale that the Pilgrims were having a celebration and the Indians just kind of happened on them, and they all just embraced and sang Kumbaya and had a big party. They were already in a cooperative situation, and that's the story of the first Thanksgiving, which was not actually Thanksgiving. It was a three-day festival of games and songs and food between the Pilgrims and the Wampanoags in Plymouth, Massachusetts. And it was many, many years later. That was 1621. It was 1863 when Abraham Lincoln proclaimed a day of Thanksgiving. And it happened to fall in harvest time, which all was appropriate. But that's the real Thanksgiving that we celebrate today is much later in history than the one that's alleged to be the first Thanksgiving, which, again, was basically a celebration of harvest, which has tied in nice in the theme way for this holiday. But that's the real story. And, of course, it's Thanksgiving week, and I would be way out of line if I didn't mention on this broadcast some things that I'm thankful for. And certainly it's right along the themes of what we talk about most weeks on this country, that I think if you're an American and you've had the opportunity to be a part of and grow up in and take advantage of the opportunities presented to you, namely your liberty, your freedom, your ability to manage your own life and chart your own destiny, to go as far as your skills and your grit and determination and particularly niche of talents will take you. That's the first thing to be thankful for on this day. And the three basic themes of our founding fathers, which I pound home every single broadcast on this program, the concepts of God, country, family, the three pillars that hold up everything that we hold dear in this country, are the things that I'm most thankful for today. Just the grace of God that has allowed me to survive and sometimes thrive and really has given me everything that I've needed to sustain myself, to create my own family who's just remarkable, and we'll get to family in just a minute. But I am humbled and absolutely abundantly blessed by beyond all imagination. And, you know, people that know me well know that I get frustrated and I tend to, air my, I guess you could call them grievances or frustrations every once in a while. But I do know at the core that no matter how much day-to-day life might get you down, that just to be blessed abundantly and have all the things that I have been able to attain, and primarily that's a good time to pivot to family. I'm sadly divorced for now, let's see what year it kind of gets muddled, but for 22 years I've been divorced, had a tremendous, heavenly God shot to even cross paths with my ex-wife, Kathy, who now is one of my dearest friends in the world, because, even though we had a rough spot and went separate ways, we both agree that was a mistake. Now we should have toughed it out. But everything's worked out, fine there, because we have the two greatest miracles in each other's respective lives, our two sons, Case and Clate. There's nothing in the world that's more important that we've accomplished. And we realize that, we collaborated on a masterpiece. I mean, some of the great teams of all time, in all kinds of fields of endeavor, go their separate ways, but the accomplishment at the end of the day is the greatest thing to be thankful for. And both our sons, and they're both very accomplished and both very talented, but I may have shared with you on this show before, what I'm really proudest of is when I see them interact with people and just see how kind and considerate and just, putting such emphasis on the feelings and desires of others over their own. And every time that I see those guys in a public setting, being introduced to someone and just how they interact, it's moments at the smallest times of being so proud of the great young men they've become. And both are in my oldest son, of course, married to Tracy, who he met in high school. They dated for 7 years all through their years at the University of Kansas, and now have given me the latest, greatest gifts in my life, two grandchildren. Can't believe Grandpa Kip, but that's, of course, my grandpa name I may have shared with you on the show before. My grandpa name is actually Cuckoo, which I know sounds unflattering, but it's got a cute story to it. My ex-wife Kathy, who's so excited. She's out there right now with them for Thanksgiving. She declared right when the king, our grandson, was being born, and yeah, they don't have high expectations for him. His name is King Kiefer. I hope he doesn't turn out to be a dishwasher, but if he does, he'll be the king of all dishwashers. On the day before he was born, my ex-wife Kathy, the mother of my children, declared, "I think my grandmother name is going to be Kiki." And of course, with Kip Kiefer's quick wit and stupidity, I declared, "Well, what does that make me? If you're Kiki, who am I? Cuckoo?" And my son Case was sitting there and he goes, "Yeah, that's it. That's going to be your grandpa name. You're going to be Cuckoo." So they taught King, my grandson, right away that I'm Grandpa Cuckoo. He still calls me Cuckoo. And I've learned to kind of love it. It's very distinctive. I don't think many grandpas out there are Cuckoo. I certainly fit the bill and check the boxes in a lot of categories. I am qualified to be Cuckoo. A lot of people think I am Cuckoo, so I'm Cuckoo officially now as a grandpa. And this April, we had the sequel, the first female Kiefer born into our family since 1961. We'd had a huge long run of males. And Aria Rain Kiefer came to be on April 10th of this calendar year, 2025. So now I've got a five-year-old grandson and a doing the math, about a seven or eight month old granddaughter. And she's starting to develop a wonderful little personality. You can crack her up when you kind of mess with her a little bit. And it's just such a blessing to look in those faces and see the future. And it really gives you a sense of perspective already being so prideful of what we've managed to contribute to the world through our sons. To see that next group, and my youngest son is heavily involved with a wonderful young lady here in Birmingham. Of course, my other son is out in Las Vegas. You hear from him on a lot of our broadcasts, and he's included. He's the sports editor of the Las Vegas Sun, covering football and all the big fights and all the big sporting events in Vegas, which has become one of the most exciting sports cities in the country. They've got every major college basketball program out there, all in the town at the same time, playing a huge tournament this week. So he'll be dizzying in his scheduling on this Thanksgiving week. But the bottom line is all of those things are such blessings, and I'm so appreciative and so thankful to God above and to the people that have helped to cultivate that and make it possible. And finally, our country. I'm so thankful to be an American. I felt this way since I was a small child. I think it's really unfair to the current young people that they have grown up in a system that de-emphasizes the miracle and the blessing it is to be an American, to grow up in this country. And yes, America is not perfect. America has a lot of blemishes, a lot of missteps, different things that could have been done differently, approached differently. But there was no blueprint. There was no script. This was an audacious experiment to come and put the emphasis on the citizens, the government of the people, by the people, for the people. There was going to be some errors along the way. There was going to be some people that got involved in leadership positions that would not live up to the billing and would make bad decisions. But all in all, this country has been the greatest sign for good, and it has fulfilled the principles of the people. Just think about the courage those men. I'm so thankful for the original settlers in this country who were seeking a better life for themselves and their family and all their ultimate descendants, including my relatives, who knew war was coming in Europe right before World War I, and got out of there in 1912, sailed the Atlantic Ocean on a not-so-luxurious ship. And my great-grandfather, Joseph, and my great-grandmother, Andula, coming from Czechoslovakia, landed at New York City, Ellis Island, took 11 hours of them waiting in a long line to be processed, stamped, certified, and officially registered as immigrants in this country. And that's the important word, immigrants, because immigration is a legal process that you have to get the paperwork and the certification that you're in the country legally, and then you can start to work towards citizenship. And that's the difference now that we have, that we from those days, everybody coming here from all over the world, they came here for one specific purpose. They wanted to be part of the American dream. They wanted to come and take advantage of what the founders pictured from a biblical passage, the shining city on the hill, which all eyes are cast upon. They came here wanting to be Americans. They did not come here waving their flag of their previous country and railing and protesting and having their hand out expecting a free lunch like this current group of people that have invaded our countries who are not here legally, have not immigrated. If you hear, and I tell you this all the time, illegal immigrants, that's once, it's like Democrat socialist. It's a contradiction of terms. If you are not in this country legally, you are not an immigrant. You are an illegal alien or an illegal invader. And every time there's one of these protests where people out there waving Palestinian flags and Mexican flags and Nicaraguan flags or wherever they came from, if you want to be somebody from another country in our country, you're not welcome here. You need to go through the process and become an American, because that's what people who came here in the early parts of the 20th century, that's what they aspired to be. They didn't want to be a Mexican living in America. They didn't want to be, whatever country you want to pick, a Somalian living in America. They wanted to be American citizens. And these people, overwhelmingly have been cultivated to be anti-American and be, you know, not only drains on our resources, but also be problems in terms of protesting our very way of life. And it's got to stop. And that's my harping on that this week. But basically, I am so thankful for my descendants and for the people that are ultimately all of our ancestors who had the guts and the courage to take the ultimate chance, get on those ships, come to a new land, and have this outrageous, audacious idea that a government that's run by the people, where the people make the decisions and forge the futures. And we've gotten away. It was not supposed to be a big federal government. It was supposed to be states. But we're starting to kind of get back to that bit of philosophy a little bit. And if we can keep stepping in that direction, we're all going to be better off. So that's the Thanksgiving message. I'm thankful for all those things. I'm thankful for all the wonderful people in my life. The proprietor of this network, Tony Curry, who gives me this platform and has worked with me closely on a lot of projects, all of the people involved in all of the endeavors that I have got going on. I want to particularly give a shout out to my partner of 10 years in broadcasting, Terry Quillian, who's one of the most remarkable individuals I've ever known, and just gives me the drive and the motivation to get up every day and try to become the best man I can be and the most accomplished I can be, because being involved with Terry is one of the great joys of my life. So many close friends growing up in Atlanta. My four best friends from high school are still my four best friends to this day. And Jim, Joe, Mark, and Steve, you guys are awesome. I have so much to be thankful for. And I'm really thankful in conclusion to all of you who tune in the show and listen to my rants and raves every week. I try to bring some things to the table to give you some things to think about. And hopefully today, talking about Thanksgiving, everybody will take a minute and think of the many blessings that all of us have in our lives and how many things we have to be thankful for. I think you'll be surprised if you just go about that process. That list gets really long, really quick, and that's what this week is all about. I'm Kip Kiefer. That's what we've got this week on Need to Know. Didn't get into anything hardcore this week, but I got a few side rants in. I want to wish all of you listening a wonderful, blessed Thanksgiving celebration. I hope it's all with family and there's love and support. Any differences, set them aside. Nothing's more important than God, country, and especially family, and really celebrate it this week. Have a wonderful week, everybody. It's the holiday season. Let's all enjoy every single moment, this great privilege we have to live in the greatest country ever conceived. Happy Thanksgiving, and thanks for listening.
This has been a special presentation of Tony Curry Radio.